It starts with you and me. It starts with you and me. We all can be heroes if we take the lead to change the bad to good, to live in harmony. It starts with you and me. Have to teach the children about living with each other, 'cause the future will soon be in their hands. Watching us close, they follow our steps. If we do right, I'm sure they'll understand.
Hello, and welcome to Spingola and Friends. It is Monday, October 20th, 2014. This is Deanna Spingola. This radio program does not have any corporate sponsors. Therefore, we are free to discuss controversial topics that are, well, not politically correct, and certainly some that you may not hear about on other radio programs. My website is spingola.com. There you will find information about my three books, the Ruling Elite series, as well as a timeline of book two and three, a work in progress, which I last updated back in June, unfortunately. I have been working on another project, so I haven't been working on the timeline. Please also visit the website of a friend and listener who has created and maintains this wonderful site. It is spingolaspeaks.wordpress.com. All of the more recent files from my programs are at that site, including the audio files from RBN and from the American Free Press Network. I've recently established a Twitter account, and that is twitter.com/Deanna Spingola. If you have questions during the program, please feel free to call in to 646-787-1915. We will be taking questions and comments from the listeners also via my email, which is comment@spingola.com, or from the chat room, which we certainly invite you to attend and to participate in, and that is spingola.chatango.com. Please remember that I do not access my regular email during the program, and I must apologize. I have been so busy with this other project that I have not been answering a lot of the email that I have received, and I do apologize for that, and I will try and catch up. I am just about done with this writing project and hope to have another book to the publisher by the end of this week. That it isn't part of my trilogy, but it's something that's very relevant and something that, it will address some issues that I think are of vital importance. Let me just say a few things about yesterday's program. I did receive an email today, and I think it's quite relevant. And this is from a gentleman that emailed me. Stephen. And he says, "Not so perfect politician, wouldn't you say? Beth Clay's boss." Now, this gentleman lived in Indiana and says that Burton is an opportunist, and I totally agree with him. I certainly didn't mean to give the impression that I was promoting any politician, because I think all of them, bar none, are opportunistic. They're all out to enrich themselves, to destroy the country, so I do not endorse any politician whatsoever. And Stephen makes the following points, or at least quotes, from a blog from a Mr. Tully, Matt Tully. And there are three things that he talks about. In 1989, Burton sued a local grocery store for $250,000 after his wife pricks her finger on a shelf. He lost the case. In 1994, he fired a bullet into a head-like object believed to be a pumpkin or watermelon in his backyard in a much-ridiculed attempt to prove a White House aide was slain. In 1995, Burton went after President Bill Clinton's cat, using his congressional influence to investigate how the White House dealt with Sox fan mail. In 1995, Burton fights new restrictions on lawmakers taking part in golf outings with lobbyists. In 1997, a lobbyist for Pakistan accused Burton of demanding campaign contributions in return for access. In 1998, while leading his bungled investigation into Clinton White House fundraising, Burton released carefully edited transcripts of a Clinton ally's conversations. The transcripts distort the overall tone of the conversations and led to Burton's fellow Republicans to criticize him. And on we go. He also admitted that, this was in 1998, that he admitted fathering a child out of wedlock in 2003. Burton and two aides take an expense-paid trip to Guam, and he later promoted pro-Guam initiatives. In 2007, Burton skipped a hearing on the treatment of injured soldiers at Walter Reed Army Medical Center. In 2007, a report finds Burton spent $702 a month in taxpayer funds for a Cadillac DeVille. Another report revealed that he paid his daughter $143,900 from campaign funds. Anyway, he's just another politician. The only good thing that he actually did was he did participate in several hearings regarding the connection between autism and vaccines, and the only reason that he probably did this was because one of his grandchildren, after having they received a vaccine and became autistic. So when that occurred, then apparently it was relevant to him. But that certainly, that's what happens. They go after the things that are personal, that personally afflict them. So he's just another creepy, scandalous, slithering politician. Alrighty, I'm on several email lists, and I got one this morning that I thought was quite interesting. It talks about coffee enemas. This is from Doctors Are Dangerous, and this is from Elaine Hollingsworth, and she has been on my program several times. Wonderful, wonderful, wonderful person. She says, a 1982 study by the U.S. National Research Council showed that coffee enemas have the power to reduce systemic toxicity by up to 700%. This is because caffeine and other beneficial compounds found in coffee, when not consumed by mouth and therefore diluted by the digestive tract, work together to stimulate the liver directly to increase production of glutathione S-transferase, a powerful detoxifying enzyme that binds with and flushes out toxins in the body. And we all need to detoxify in some way. When food is not properly digested, it can become fermented, putrefied, or rotted in the colon, producing toxins that are absorbed into the liver. This process is a common factor in the development of health complications, with many complaining of impaired digestion. By increasing bile flow and facilitating the release of toxins from the large intestine, coffee enemas help ensure the body does not reabsorb these harmful chemicals. Plus, more bile means a more alkaline small intestine, which helps to improve the digestive process. Credit for the discovery of coffee enemas for pain relief go to a nurse in World War One, in the World War One German Army Field Hospital. At a time when painkillers were scarce, the nurse found that administering enemas to badly wounded soldiers caused almost immediate relief from what was often profound and persistent pain. The deep cleansing and detoxification effects of routine enemas not only helped to heal existing health conditions, but also helped the body to perform the innate healing functions more easily. A properly functioning internal environment is less susceptible to the development of chronic or degenerative illness. Because of its particularly powerful detoxing effects, coffee enemas transform the tired, sluggish body, overburdened by toxicity, into a cleaner, clearer, and more effective eliminator. The impacts of this dramatic shift are palpable and can leave a person feeling high, with more energy, greater mental clarity, and wider grins. Okay, that's a very interesting thing. As I mentioned, feel free to call into the program at 646-787-1915. On July 31st, 2014, Barack Obama signed an amendment to an executive order amending Executive Order 13295, which was produced in 2003 by George W. Bush. And the new amendment allows the government to apprehend and detain Americans who show signs of any respiratory illness. Now, I want to point something out to you, that top U.S. Ebola men are Jewish. And this is from, well, it is from, let's see, it is from a Jewish site, actually. They were quite proud of the fact that they were in charge. All right, just checking the chat room here. All righty. Back to my notes. A lot of people have asked me about my views of Christianity and other things, and I responded to a listener just recently with something that I had included in the foreword of one of my books as follows. In 1926, General Sherip Spiridovich wrote, and I quote, "War is only a legalized mass murder. Thus, Christ pointed out those who arrange all wars and revolutions, and that their chief cause is Satan and his son's lust of murder. However, Christians never seem to agree with Christ. Essentially, in accepting pro-war propaganda, we abandon Christianity and acquiesce to the mass slaughter of strangers targeted by the warmongers. In effect, we idolatrously worship the golden calf of the banker-backed synthetic state when we abandon the peaceful tenets of Christianity. If double-minded individuals, either naively or knowingly, promote war while claiming to abhor abortion, we absolutely must evaluate their motives and loyalties and then withhold our support for warfare. In Christianity, there should be no fence sitting, no serving of two masters. The Ten Commandments include, thou shalt have no other gods before me, and ye shall not murder. Communists and socialists who, like Lucifer, are rebellious towards God, attempt to replace him and impose their own laws upon the naive masses. An authoritative state advocates, with numerous deceitful justifications, mass murder through warfare, actually genocide of entire foreign populations. Like Lucifer, since Lincoln's war, the war planners always shift the blame for the initiation of warfare onto others via the use of false flag operations, which brings me to another subject. And that subject is Hitler. I received an email a couple of days ago stating that Hitler developed Ebola to use as a biological weapon. I also, which is ridiculous because it was not even discovered until 1976. Now, Hitler, of course, we know, was born in 1889. I receive regularly emails from people in the alleged alternative media who claim that Hitler was a Jewish pawn and that he started World War II, that the NSDAP members were all homosexuals, people who regularly make some of the ludicrous claims that we have all heard fall into various categories. While I dislike categorizing people, I will make an exception in this case. The people who are typically vilifying Hitler fall into, well, eight categories, at least eight categories. Number one, they are working for Jewish interest. Number two, they are Jews. Number three, they are incredibly ignorant. Number four, they do not know how to conduct research. Number five, they are paid agents. Number six, they like to create divisions in order to create dissent and disunity. They create sides in order to discredit real researchers and scientists. Number seven, working for Jewish or government interest, and that seems to be redundant. Number eight, they are useful idiots. So those are the categories. I have reiterated numerous times on my programs that if an individual is conducting adequate research, they will inevitably find the truth. Anyone who is engaged in research must look at the available resources, meaning that he or she will objectively look at the documents and compiled resources regarding any topic. Now, I hate to say that there are sides, because I believe that when you're talking about the truth is the truth. It doesn't have a side. It doesn't have a bias. The truth is simply the truth. So I don't like to say, well, you look at both sides of the issue, but I will say that you look at, when we're talking about Hitler, that you should look at the German records, that you should look at the Germany's, what was going on in Germany, what had gone on in Germany, what went on in Germany following the war, and I'm talking about both wars, following World War I and World War II. Okay, now as I mentioned, Hitler was born in 1889. He did not start America's Civil War. He didn't start World War I, didn't start World War II, did not kill 6 million. And would you believe on one website, they had it listed that he had killed 11 million Jews. Now, there were not 6 million Jews under German jurisdiction at any time during World War II. Germany never, ever engaged in false flag attacks. The Germans and Hitler did not attack the USS Liberty. They did not orchestrate 9/11. Hitler was not on crystal meth. He was not a homosexual. And on one side it says, Hitler is considered one of the most evil people in history because of the Holocaust. And yet, I know from doing scientific research and from looking at the scientific research of others, the Holocaust did not happen. It was logistically impossible. And so Germany, I must also reiterate, Germany was a Jewish target long before Hitler's birth in 1889. The Marxists had targeted Germany Well, in 1848. And I've talked about this in my book. Now, I hate to promote myself. I really do. Yeah, I just feel very uncomfortable doing that. But let me just give you some of the titles in Book 3. And Book 3 covers so many issues. It covers World War II. And it starts out with one part, Hitler and the Rebirth of Germany. And let me give you the chapter titles. The Advent of Adolf Hitler, Hitler's Assumption of Power, The Worldwide Masonic Brotherhood. I talk about Freemasonry. I talk about the official history of Adolf Hitler. Now, by official history, it means the history that was devised to make him look really, really, really bad, which was being devised before he even became chancellor. I talk about the so-called Dick Adolf Hitler, and there's a chapter called We Are Going to Lick That Fellow Hitler, and that is a statement that was made by one of the top Jewish people. And the reason that they were so upset about Hitler was because he kicked the bankers out of the country. He kicked the Jewish bankers out of the country. He would not accept the idea of usury. They had no gold. They had no credit. They had nothing but debt, starvation, and a destroyed economy after World War I. The Weimar Republic was destroying the country morally. And he is one of the few politicians who actually ignored the bankers and rebuilt the country, put more than 6 million people back to work, and set an example for Europe. And if the other countries had followed suit, it would have been the end for the banking industry, for the bankers who were exploiting the rest of the population, the worldwide population. So let me just check and see if we have any phone calls. Okay, we do have a phone call. Let's go ahead and take this. All right, 111.
Would you mind if I change the subject temporarily over to the pharmaceutical issues that you were discussing on your program yesterday?
Sure, go ahead, Russ.
Yeah, there was speculation, you know, about I was just guessing and thinking that there are 10 times as many Americans receiving vaccinations, drugs, and medical screenings today than there were a few decades ago.
Right, and I did pose that question to the guest. And she wasn't sure that it was that the 10 times was accurate.
Right. So what I did is I was curious also because I had just been guessing. So I did a little bit of research, and here's what I found. In 1980, prescription drugs was a $12 billion per year industry. In 2010, it was a $276 billion industry. So from 1980 to 2010, which is 30 years later, the figure had grown from $12 billion to $276 billion.
Right, yeah.
That's pretty staggering. Another thing I found out, which you probably know, but I wasn't aware of, is that in every country in the world, it's not allowed to advertise, direct-to-consumer advertise prescription drugs as they do on TV, you know.
Well, let me just interrupt for just a moment. They allow it in New Zealand, and they allow it in America, and those are the only two countries that allow direct-to-consumer advertising for prescriptive drugs.
Great. And also in the U.S., the cost of the drugs is considerably more than it is in countries, all of the other countries where they don't allow the advertising. And I think, you know, another little fact I found out is the research done by the pharmaceutical companies shows that for every dollar they spend on advertising, they get $4.20 increase in the retail sales. So it's, wouldn't that account for the, you know, all the, because 20 years ago, I don't know when they started advertising in TV, but I mean, when I was a kid, on TV they would advertise over-the-counter drugs like aspirin and such.
Sure.
But all of a sudden, the last few years, I was noticing they're advertising all these prescription drugs on TV, and I'm wondering if that wouldn't account for part of the reason why the sales have increased so dramatically and why there are so many more Americans on drugs today than there were maybe before the advertising. Do you think so? I don't know.
Yes. They started this advertising in 1997, and it increased the sales by 300% of pharmaceutical drugs, so that now that the patient can go into the doctor, they can listen to these advertisements on TV, go into the doctor and ask for a prescription, and of course the doctor is going to go ahead and give them that prescription with very little questions asked. And and the other purpose that it serves with the direct to consumer advertising is that if the patient does not read the drug insert, then they still have there's a public announcement about the side effects of these drugs. And so if a person suffers from these side effects, then all they have to the drug company can say, well, gosh, I mean, we've made it perfectly clear that there are some very serious issues, very serious problems, and we're very sorry that you're having these issues, but you were warned, right? So it's for legal purposes, for making more money, and they put more money into advertising than they do into research. And many of the drugs that they are now selling are really repackaged from. They're not doing any new research. They're not looking for to help people. They are looking for profit and profit only. And anyway, it's something that I cover in my project that I'm going to be sending the manuscript in for, hopefully by the end of the week. Russ, did you have any other comments?
I should say I was planning to just send you that on, you know, at your comment at spingola.com, but I tried to listen to your podcast on the website, and what it does is it plays your voice for about 2 seconds, then there's a 30-second gap, then 2 seconds more of your voice, and then another 30-second gap, and that went on for about 10 or 15 minutes, and so it was impossible to listen to the broadcast. It just isn't working. You just get little blips here and there.
Now, were you listening to which broadcast, on RBN or?
No, the one you're doing right now. You know, I Googled, I typed in Spingola and Friends on Blog Talk Radio, okay, and it took me to, it shows today's episode and it says, 15 seconds before the broadcast, and that part was working. The time runs down, and it says, okay, the broadcast has begun. There's an hour and 57 minutes left.
Uh-huh.
But when you listen to it, you get your voice for 2 seconds and then 30 seconds of silence and so on, and it just continued that way for 10 or 15 minutes. So I decided the only way I'm going to be able to listen to the broadcast would be to call the number.
Oh, okay. All righty. Yeah, I'm sorry. I'm not sure why that is happening. I don't know. And, of course, you can people generally, to hear it, go to blogtalkradio.com/Deanna2, and you should be able to hear it. I'm not sure. Maybe
that's
there's some
that's
comments.
That's the website I was on. That's the website I was on, and it's the technical difficulties. Yeah.
Okay. You might go to the chat room, which is spingola.chatango.com, and see if they have we have a lot of very bright people who visit the chat room, and maybe they have some suggestions, because I'm not sure what to do. Maybe listen to it in another browser. I know that that in the Opera browser I have trouble with Blog Talk Radio, so I have to actually listen to or broadcast from Internet Explorer because of the problems that I had in Opera. So that might be an issue. It might be the browser that you're using. Anyway,
I don't know.
Do you have any other comments or questions? Because we
do
have another.
I could make a comment. I could make a comment about. Maybe I won't get into that subject. But, you know, when you were saying about the wars being started by Lucifer and such as that, I mean, to me, I think wars, you know, are started by people.
Sure. But that, I was just filling in from what the general said, you know, and what, just my feelings.
Right.
I believe that there is evil in the world. But I do have some other topics that I want to cover. So.
Okay. Alrighty.
I appreciate your support, and I appreciate your comments and your contributions.
Can I just continue to hold and listen then?
Because of course.
Okie doke.
Yeah, that would be great. Thank you.
Thank you,
Russ.
Bye-bye.
All righty. Let's go to, let's go to 708.
Hi, Diana. It's Jeff.
Hi. How are you?
Good. I just wanted to add to what the fellow just said. I couldn't get in at all in the last few minutes on my main desktop, which I've never had a problem before with the show or any show. But it runs Windows. It runs XP Professional. So I went to my laptop, which was Win7 Professional, and I got right in. And I used, by the way, my browser's Firefox. So I don't. It might be something on Blog Talk. And I haven't done computer maintenance on my main desktops, but I just wanted to throw that in. There was somebody else that had a problem, but I can get it on my laptop. So I don't want to hold you up. I don't have anything to add because I haven't heard the show yet. So I just wanted to throw that in there for you, okay?
Okay. Well, thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Appreciate
Bye.
That. Bye-bye. All righty. Any comments or questions, feel free to call in at 646-787-1915. And I'm not sure what's going on with Blog Talk. I will certainly attempt to check that out. Alrighty, I shared some information with you from book 3. I do have that book available if you want to order it. And like I said, I don't like to self-promote, but it is available at Amazon, and it fills in a lot of questions about World War III, and that's the basic topic of the book. And it has a lot of footnotes. I spent a lot of time researching it. I've also spent a lot of time, many years in fact, engaging in family history research, which involved looking at hundreds of rolls of microfilmed census records, mortality schedules, original court and probate documents, birth, death, and church records. In fact, it was from doing that kind of research that I learned how to do research. Now, the majority of my ancestors were agrarian. They were large and small landowners who grew and ate what they produced. Most of them arrived in America relatively early, while a few others arrived later when they purchased land and farmed. For the most part, they lived long and healthy lives, many into their 90s. In this country, none of them were factory workers or mine workers, nor did they congregate in large cities where open sewage frequently ran in the streets. None of them ever lived in the rat-infested tenements in Manhattan owned by the Astor family. One of the few cases of an infectious disease that I encountered in the records that I perused was my second great-grandmother, Francis, who was born in England. Francis was a servant who, at age 16, married Robert, a laborer, and thereafter they resided in Sittingbourne, Kent. Now, this county, which they call it a shire in England, is bounded on the north by the Thames, or Thames, estuary, and on the east and south by the Straits of Dover. On the west, the northern end of the county boundary is contiguous with London. Kent experienced outbreaks of cholera in 1846 to 1854, and in 1863 to 1868, which was caused by sewage-contaminated water. Periodically, diphtheria, typhoid, and scarlet fever also created havoc among the residents. Local authorities instructed the people who were vulnerable to cholera to practice good sanitation and to eat wholesome food. Francis and Robert had four boys, one of which died at the age of just 2 weeks. Evidently wanting a better life, they emigrated from England, and they departed on March 12, 1854 from Liverpool with their three surviving children, arriving in New Orleans 2 months later on May 2, 1854. Frances never actually set foot in New Orleans, as she had cholera and was quarantined on an island 4 miles south of St. Louis. She died on May 16th, along with many others who traveled on a crowded ship that lacked proper facilities. In 1854, after a London physician, John Snow, concluded that the cholera epidemic was a result of the contaminated water from the community street pump, he persuaded the city council to close the pump, which ended that epidemic. This led to a national health movement and an improvement in sanitary conditions. All right, we have another caller. Let's take 304. 304, welcome.
Yeah, excuse me. Hi, Deanna. This is Kent from West Virginia.
And hi.
The previous callers, some months back, I couldn't get this blog spot thing to work at all. And I actually contacted them in some fashion, and they wrote back, and they said it's cookies. And what you want to do is you want to hold your control key down and press the F5 key. And that removes the cookies or clears the cache, as they said.
Ah.
I did it, and it works. And periodically, I have a little message taped on my computer, and every once in a while I just tape it, and now it works. But I couldn't get it to work at all. So yeah, I've got this message, delete browser, cookies, and clear cache. Hold down control key and press F5 key. And that might work.
Perfect. Thank you so much, Kent. That's great.
All right,
okay.
All right, thanks.
All righty. Take care.
Bye.
Bye-bye. Kent always says something wonderful to contribute, and Russ does also. He emails me, and he likes to keep people on their toes, the hosts on their toes. So thank you both, gentlemen. All righty. I was talking about my ancestors. And because I think that if people can relate situations to their own family, that they can better understand things. And this was something that I could relate to. And when I've talked with Roman, who was a guest in the third hour yesterday and was previously a guest, Roman Bistrioni, he and Dr. Suzanne Humphreys have done such an incredible job on the book that they created, and particularly about the history of vaccines. And it's imperative that people understand history. I've always said history is prologue, and it doesn't matter what you're talking about. It doesn't matter what you're applying that to. History is prologue. If you want to understand what's going on in politics today, you look at history. If you want to understand what's going on in health today, you look at history. Whatever you want to understand, you have to evaluate history and the perspective that it gives to you to be able to understand current contemporary events. So anyway, getting back to England, Parliament mandated that every adult person resident in England and Wales on January 1st, 1856, who had not already been successfully vaccinated, nor had smallpox, in other words, natural immunity, be vaccinated by a duly qualified practitioner or by a public vaccinator. Now, that term was, well, interesting, because when I saw that term, I thought of the drugstores that currently have people that will give you these vaccinations. And I'm thinking, well, they must be a public vaccinator. And of course, they give you these vaccines without telling you that all the stuff that they could cause. But anyway, they had the residents in England had to be vaccinated by within 3 months of January 1st, 1856, or submit to an inspection by a doctor or public vaccinator 8 days after vaccination under a penalty of £1. Now, so they either did what they were told or they had to pay a fee. Adults not born in England or Wales but coming to reside therein also had to be vaccinated if they had not already received a vaccination, a smallpox vaccination, within 3 months of their arrival, or they had to pay £1. Parents were to take their children to be vaccinated within 3 months after that date and be inspected 8 days after vaccination under a penalty of £1. Now, in another branch of my family, Union soldiers at Antietam killed my second great-grandfather. While he was shot in the bloodiest single-day battle of the so-called Civil War, most people who perish during warfare die from disease caused by incredibly unsanitary practices, the lack of good hygiene, the overcrowding, living in tents, and urinating and defecating just outside of the tents or in nearby streams. There are more people that die during warfare from disease than by enemy by combat. Often, soldiers positioned their latrines right next to the water supply, which contaminated the water. Dysentery accounted for about 45,000 deaths in the Union Army and about 50,000 deaths in the Confederate Army. Measles took the lives of about 11,000 soldiers. 3/5 of the deaths in the Union Army were from disease. In the Confederacy, it was 2/3 of the deaths. Disease was the single most important factor in the deaths during that fratricidal conflict. Measles and smallpox were common diseases during the Civil War, even before the men engaged in battle. Fresh fruits and vegetables were often unavailable at overcrowded military training camps, sometimes leading to scurvy. Malaria was common in the hot, swampy areas in the South. Bad water and improper sanitation caused widespread dysentery, and exposure to the elements led to pneumonia. Other health issues included typhoid fever, diphtheria, mumps, chickenpox, whooping cough, and tuberculosis. All of these septic conditions, whether in overcrowded cities, unsanitary towns, or military field camps, cause disease. Mass vaccination did not eradicate them. Adhering to hygienic living standards decreased the incidence of disease. In 1859, in England, they had begun construction of the London sewage system, which took 6 years to complete. Parliament passed the Sewage Utilization Act in 1865 and the Sanitary Act in 1866. The government assumed the maintenance and regulation of the sewage and water systems. It also prohibited the overcrowding of residences. Other countries soon followed England's positive example, despite the objections of the slumlords. In 1860, in America, New York had the highest death rate of any city, mostly because the slumlords enjoyed the support of Tammany Hall, a corrupt entity that had appointed health officers to run the health department. Angry citizens appealed to officials in Albany, who finally initiated an investigation that led to some relief. By 1866, New York City had a board of health that functioned a bit more efficiently. Now, it's very interesting that during the 1830s, there were still outdoor toilets, outhouses, even in the Chicago area. So, and it is amazing that people would offer to go and fight in a foreign country that had actually updated and were improving their infrastructure, improving their water systems, improving their hygienic facilities, that these people, people from Chicago and New York, where they were still had these issues, would go and fight against a country, Germany, that was trying to alleviate these kinds of problems. And it's hard to imagine that people initially resisted better hygiene, such as frequent bathing and the regular use of soap, which many claimed was detrimental to one's skin. They thought it unnecessary and felt that the body odor was natural and normal. Yikes. Hygiene advocates set new standards, making cleanliness the key to the hygienic movement of the 19th and 20th centuries. Renters appealed for renovations in the terrible housing conditions, which forced owners to make improvements in the tenements. There was a movie that talked about this. I can't remember the name of the movie. I'm certain that somebody in the chat room would probably remember the name of this movie. But it was awful. It was just awful the way that the people were forced to live in order to work in the new industrial plants. It was just a terrible situation. Absolutely awful, the way that it was portrayed in the movie. Now, I know that movies aren't exactly, they don't exactly represent life, but I believe that just in my study of history and reading about the stuff in history, things were pretty awful. Unless you lived on a farm and grew your own food and took care of your family in this way, life was pretty difficult in the big city. So the owners, the slumlords, were forced to close the vermin-infested cellars where many of the poor had existed in misery. By 1870, officials closed all the cellars and basements, and then the government conducted a survey of the tenements and directed the owners to make improvements and to make them habitable. Governments made plans to remove numerous businesses that polluted neighborhoods where people lived. They went after the slaughterhouses, the meatpacking plants, the glue factories, the tanneries, and the other manufacturers. And they slowly began pushing the offending and polluting industries outside of the city limits. In 1871, in Bavaria, out of 30,742 cases of smallpox, 29,429 of the victims had been vaccinated, which connotes to 95.7%. So the individuals among the unvaccinated who contracted smallpox numbered 1,313, or 4.3%. Recently, most of the breakouts have been among individuals who have been vaccinated. And I'm not talking about smallpox. I'm talking about whooping cough. I'm talking about chickenpox. I'm talking about measles. The outbreaks have been among individuals who have been vaccinated, not among those who have not. Now, the smallpox epidemic of 1872-1873 in Boston killed 1,040 people, and it occurred among a vaccinated population because they believed in herd vaccination. Now, the majority of the population of Chicago, over 95%, was vaccinated by the end of 1868. Government officials required that those receiving assistance following the Great Fire, which occurred in 1871, had to accept the smallpox vaccination. Now, I'm giving you all of this information because with this stupid Ebola scare, the government will attempt to force a vaccination upon the population. And out of fear, many people, particularly those who endorse vaccines, are going to accept this vaccine, which will probably cause all kinds of horrible health issues. So anyway, getting back in 1872, despite or because of the vaccinations, a horrific smallpox epidemic erupted in Chicago, afflicting more than 2,000 people, during which over a quarter of the victims died, most of whom were children under the age of 5. The concept of herd mentality did not save the Chicago population from the scourge of smallpox. Many of the vaccinated population in France, Germany, and England were also afflicted. French army officials required the smallpox vaccination of every recruit in the army during the Franco-Prussian War, which was from July 19, 1870 to May 10, 1871. Smallpox afflicted 23,469 soldiers just in the French army. The London Lancet of July 15, 1871 reported that 6,854 out of 9,392 smallpox victims in the London hospitals had been vaccinated. Almost 18% of those patients died. In England, over 122,000 vaccinated individuals were stricken with smallpox. The official reports from Germany stated that between 1870 and 1885, 1 million vaccinated persons died as a result of contracting smallpox. Medical authorities over-vaccinated the Italian population, and by 1899, there was a smallpox epidemic, which killed a total of 18,110 individuals in various villages of Italy, all of whom had received 2 vaccinations each year for many, many years. In 1876, Dr. James J. Garth Wilkinson said, let me just check the chat room here, okay. We don't have any callers. If you did want to make a comment, please feel free to call in to 646-787-1915. Okay, I'm going between the chat room and Blog Talk Radio, so I can try and monitor both, and so bear with me when I'm making that transition. I'm not a great multitasker, but I'm trying here. Okay, Dr. James Wilkinson said, and I quote, "Compulsory vaccination is an instance of law which inflicts actual disease and possible death on the human body and propagates and disseminates deadly infections widely upon animals and mankind. This is surely a glaring instance of a law which is not based on wisdom or sanity and is a menace to the health and security of humanity and the state. This amazing act is homicidal insanity of a whole profession. This is blood assassination," unquote. Now, prior to the Civil War, and that quote came out of his book, which is called The Horrors of Vaccination, Exposed and Illustrated. It was written in 1920, from page 5. Prior to the Civil War, In the 1850s, people disposed of sewage and wastewater in open ditches. Soon, individuals created what they called a water closet, a room with a toilet for the suitable disposal of human waste. By 1895, 40 properties had water closets, and by 1904, there would be 1,506. Previously, in the larger cities, especially among the poor, people disposed of excrement into the streets from where it ultimately wound up in the drinking water. In 1908, officials began chlorinating the water supply in larger cities, which eliminated waterborne diseases such as cholera, typhoid, and dysentery. They developed a water network that ultimately delivered water to private homes. In 1909, New York allowed people to connect water closets to the municipal sewage system, and after consideration, officials constructed the first water waste treatment plant. On the evening of May 7, 1847, delegates to the National, I'm kind of backtracking, but giving you a little bit of history here, delegates to the National Medical Convention had resolved to establish the American Medical Association, the AMA, a private organization of allopathic physicians, as a unified white-coated trade union or a secret society, depending on perspective. It could effectively influence legislation to eliminate competition. On April 14, 1897, the AMA was incorporated in Chicago. They created a profit-based medical system to focus on treating symptoms with chemicals, surgery, and the promotion of vaccines instead of addressing the causes of disease. By the turn of the 20th century, people using better sanitation had almost eradicated smallpox in the United States. By the fall of 1897, smallpox was not the killer that it had been, and only one in 380 people perished instead of the previous rate of one in five. The disease, not as severe, now resembled other skin eruptions. By then, many people acknowledged that better sanitation, food, and water had done more for the huge reduction of dread disease than the vaccine had done. Okay. In 1900, about 50,000 medical or medicinal products were sold in the United States of two types. Thousands of independent companies sold syrups, elixirs, and herbal remedies to the public. Merck and other companies sold their chemical preparations. So you have this big division that started as early as, 1897 or before, but it was when the AMA actually became formalized in 1897 that the problems began. And the Merck and other companies sold their chemical preparations to pharmacists who sold them to the public. There was no regulatory agency who reviewed these products for safety or efficacy. The AMA created a propaganda department and a council on pharmacy and chemistry to evaluate and test herbal remedies, claiming that it wanted to safeguard the population from quackery. The AMA issued its negative conclusions in its journal while awarding and praising the new chemical potions. Every year, the American Medical Association published a list of the most useful drugs in book form. It prohibited advertisements in its journal of any drug that failed its evaluation process. In other words, anything that was natural, anything that was herbal, didn't get any credit at all. The decrease of smallpox in America coincided with the United States invasion of the Philippines in 1897. The invasion actually occurred a year later. One of the first provisions that the U.S. military makes when it invades another country is the mandatory vaccination of its inhabitants. Now, I'm not sure it's mandatory in every country, but it's, it kind of happens. In 1903, after the invasion, the military, despite the natives' vibrant health, enacted a compulsory countrywide smallpox vaccination program. They rounded up the unwilling Filipinos and herded them into vaccination centers. By 1905, there was a smallpox epidemic and numerous deaths, and by 1910, vaccination was mandatory. Given the smallpox outbreak in a relatively virgin population, one would suppose that the government would halt the program there and in America. Instead, it increased the program, which produced another epidemic in 1907 and 1908. Many doctors and statisticians determined that the vaccine program increased the incidence of smallpox and also charged the drug companies and the doctors used the population as guinea pigs for their experimental drugs and vaccines. The U.S. military is now one of the biggest vaccine and drug company customers. Companies lobby the government to inoculate all military personnel at taxpayer expense. What a scam. The earlier manufacturers viewed the 11 million Filipinos under military occupation as a profitable market, especially for the overstocked or spoiled vaccines. Otherwise, they would have used them on senior citizens, orphans, institutionalized soldiers, or prisoners. Drug companies view children in the foster care system as guinea pigs. Vaccines cause preventable diseases such as typhoid, malaria, beriberi, and tuberculosis, and they cause these in the Philippines. The biological experimentation in the Philippines provided a testing ground for introducing the beginnings of socialized medicine in America through the imposition of compulsory vaccination programs in the government schools. America is one of the sickest nations in the world, despite the claims that it has the world's best health care system. In 1907, Dr. Charles Page noted that it was not necessary to use injections of disease matter to battle diphtheria, that it was sanitation, hygiene, and changing the standard of living that would be used to defeat this and other diseases. It is not by adding disease to disease that the evil of diphtheria will be combated, but it is by the removal of the dark, damp, ill-ventilated slums which infest our towns and cities by letting light and air into the overcrowded and unsanitary dwellings of the poor, and by the inculcation of lessons of cleanliness and hygiene among the people. And this is from Dr. Humphreys and Roman's book. Okay, what the Rockefellers wanted to do was to eliminate healthcare competition. So in June 1901, John D. Rockefeller Sr. had founded the Rockefeller Institute for Medical Research, just 4 years after the incorporation of the AMA. Now, it was the very first institution of that kind in America, and Simon Flexner, the brother of Abraham, was its first director. Rockefeller and others saw unique possibilities in a pharmaceutical market. In 1909, the Carnegie Foundation for the Advancement of Teaching funded Abraham Flexner's investigative tour of 155 medical schools in America and Canada. He concluded that medical education in America was abysmal. Flexner submitted his 364-page report, which is titled Medical Education in the United States and Canada, and this was Carnegie Foundation Bulletin Number 4, to the Carnegie Foundation, which was a Rockefeller collaborator, which they published in 1910. And this called for a drastic reform in America's medical education. Flexner emphasized the need for the increasing importance of the AMA's Council on Medical Education and its inspection and ratings of medical schools. However, the council had to maintain a fragile balance because the AMA ban only represented a small percentage of America's physicians. Flexner determined that any instruction that failed to utilize the new progressive drugs to treat their patients amounted to quackery. The AMA officials informed medical schools that included studies in bioelectrical medicine, homeopathy, or Eastern medicine that they would have to discontinue these courses or forfeit their accreditation. Ultimately, the majority of the schools either closed their doors or adapted. Johns Hopkins University was Flexner's ideal medical school as it promoted surgery and drugs rather than holistic and natural methods. Members of Congress, always happy to acquiesce to the demands of deep-pocketed industrialists, readily accepted his recommendations and the alleged need for public protection. Congress decided that the AMA would function as the ever-vigilant doorkeeper and authorized it to officially approve or disapprove of any of the nation's medical schools based on its criteria. In 1906, there were 160 medical schools in America. By 1920, there would only be 85, and by 1944, there were only 69 medical schools in the country. Abraham Flexner, as a member of the General Education Board of the Rockefeller Foundation, controlled the distribution of about $50 million. He anticipated that the philanthropic grants would stimulate competition among the nation's medical schools. Naturally, when schools receive foundation grants, they are obligated to support a certain scientific, and that's in quote, scientific track, even if it countered previous proven methods. AMA members controlled the licensing boards and designed the examination questions to differentiate students who graduated from so-called unscientific schools. The corporate media, in conjunction with the AMA, waged a ruthless campaign of disinformation and deception while deliberately concealing successful alternative remedies and the practitioners who actually helped their patients. And going back to Charles M. Higgins, on September 17, 1919, Dr. Higgins, the author of The Horrors of Vaccination, and that is available online for free as a PDF file, Horrors of Vaccinations, said, and I quote, "In order that there shall be no misunderstanding about the serious charge I bring against vaccination as being now actually more dangerous to public health and human life than natural smallpox, an equally serious charge which I make against vaccinating doctors who now control our Department of Health and vital statistics of denying and concealing these facts from the people, I now issue this special challenge to the Department of Health of the City and State of New York, which cover a population of 11 million, and with whose records I am more familiar, that I will undertake to prove from their death certificates and vital records, now concealed and withheld from the public, that there have been more deaths from vaccination than from smallpox in every year for the past 15 years in the city and state of New York. If they deny the truth of these charges, I further solemnly challenge them to open their now concealed records to public examination, and I will prove the truth of my charges from these records. Will they now dare to deny these charges, or will they dare to refuse to open their heretofore hermetically concealed records to give the full medical and statistical truth to the people on these most important points?" Excuse me, unquote. So here was a doctor in 1919, Dr. Higgins, who wrote this fabulous book and who was trying to warn the people. And sad stuff. Let me just get a drink of my, what am I drinking today? I've got three bottles here on my desk. I have a bottle of kombucha, cranberry ginger. I have a bottle of Bragg organic apple cider vinegar, apple cinnamon flavor, and I have a bottle of filtered water. All righty. Now, 1919 was a very interesting time. Of course, that was right at the end of World War I. Millions of people, millions of Americans participated in World War I, including Smedley D. Butler, who went to France as commander of the 13th Marines. On September 24, 1918, Butler's men arrived at Brest, B-R-E-S-T. And although they were Marines, they were placed under the jurisdiction of the U.S. Army. Butler was promoted to a brigadier general on October 7th, 1918, and after 2 weeks, Commander General John J. Pershing relocated Butler and his men to the Army debarkation camp at, how do you pronounce this, Pontenaisin, France, a filthy 1,700-acre pestilence-infested mud flat where 75,000 American soldiers were crammed together, forced to share inadequate sanitation facilities. Okay, so I've talked about the Civil War and the filth and the disease. And John Pershing, General Pershing, sends these Marines to this filth, 17-acre infested mud flat. Well, at least 16,000 of those soldiers were suffering from influenza. An average of 25 soldiers died each day from that and other diseases. In usual Butler fashion. Now, I just highly respect General Butler. Smedley Butler was a hero in my estimation. In usual Butler fashion, he turned the camp into a model of efficiency. His treatment of the troops was admirable. He gave them double rations of food, an adequate number of blankets, and provided them with a dry sleeping area. He cared more about the men than the regulations that he broke to make them comfortable. He always favored his men, who had very little, if any, power against their so-called superior officers. Toward the end of the war, the technicians had gathered up all the vaccines on the lab shelves and vaccinated every single U.S. soldier. The first time in history that a government had mandated compulsory inoculations in the military. This poisonous medical assault, the Schick diphtheria vaccine, outlawed years before in Austria due to the deaths of several children, killed more American soldiers than the war. The Austrian government banned the use of Bella vaccine and banished him from the country. And I think that most of you are familiar with Protocol Number 10, which says the inoculation of diseases. And if you want to know more about Protocol 10, just send me an email. Okay, so Bella Schick, that's S-C-H-I-C-K, was banned from Austria. By 1923, Schick directed the pediatric department at the Mount Sinai Hospital in New York. In 1936, he became a professor at Columbia University. He headed the pediatric department at Beth El Hospital in Brooklyn from 1950 to 1962. Doctors still used the Schick test, invented in 1910-1911, to determine whether a person is susceptible to diphtheria. Despite recruiting propaganda, the military were and are now underpaid, used as medical guinea pigs, exposed to death and disease, and often abandoned as POWs or MIAs. Butler, torn by what he witnessed, wrote, and I quote, "The wounded and maimed passed through Pontenaisin, some with their nervous systems irreparably shattered. Gradually, it began to dawn on me to wonder what on earth these American boys are doing, getting wounded and killed and buried in France, unquote. He began to, and I quote, doubt the ethics of his chosen calling, unquote. And he wrote about this in his book. Let's see, what was the name of his book? Warfare is a Racket. War is a Racket. Wonderful, wonderful book. In February 1927, Dr. William W. Keene, K-E-E-N, America's first brain surgeon, wrote an article for the American Review of Reviews, check the time, in which he praised the effectiveness of the vaccine program in the Philippines, even though there had been, by 1921, 130,264 cases of smallpox. Remember, there had never been a case of smallpox. And it resulted in the death of 74,369 deaths. It killed nearly half the people who got the smallpox. That's a crime. The mortality rate varied from 25 to 75%, depending on the location in the islands. There were fewer cases of smallpox in the more remote jungle areas where people fled to avoid shots. But in the cities where they vaccinated people, the epidemics were a calamity. The worst smallpox statistics in the world, along with the highest percentages of vaccinations. Thanks to the U.S. government in bed with the pharmaceutical industry and the American Medical Association. Given the consequences, scientific studies and historical facts resulting from vaccinations, it is unwise to believe in media propaganda and the government lies claiming that vaccines are a harmless method of immunization, especially against diseases that have already been eradicated. Instead of protecting an individual against disease, the vaccines with highly questionable ingredients, including animal and human byproducts, cannot help but cause harm and diminish the immune system's ability to fight the opportunistic diseases that would otherwise not be problematic. The AMA, a doctor's labor union, or as I mentioned before, a secret society, established itself as the pharmaceutical industry's advocate, along with its products. The two entities formed a symbiotic relationship to exploit the public and create a customer base for the doctors who, with their handy-dandy drug book, could prescribe the drugs produced by the drug companies. This unhealthy alliance enhanced the physician's credibility, as he was authorized and knowledgeable on what drugs to prescribe for his patients. The 1838 Drug and Cosmetic Act soon altered the way that the retailing of drugs was handled in the United States. It mandated that the FDA had to validate the safety, but not the efficacy, of drugs produced by the industry. The FDA stipulated individuals could buy certain drugs only with a doctor's prescription. In 1951, with the Durham-Humphrey Amendment, most new drugs, such as antibiotics and any refills, were only obtainable with a doctor's prescription, which elevated them to a privileged position. Essentially, physicians touting the newest and most effective drugs became agents for the pharmaceutical companies, with pharmacists as intermediaries. Physicians supported and licensed by the AMA and the drug industry were allies. In 1952, the AMA discontinued publishing its annual book listing the most useful drugs and began allowing drug companies to advertise in its journal those drugs approved by the AMA Council on Pharmacy and Chemistry. By 1957, the AMA decreased the budget for its Council on Drugs, and it, along with its licensed physicians, was now actively working with the drug companies to stimulate the sales of new drugs. Doctor salaries began to increase dramatically, doubling from 1950 to 1970. Advertisements for drugs increased the AMA's revenues from $2.5 million in 1950 to $10 million in 1960. In 1959, a researcher reviewed the drug advertisements in six medical journals and discovered that 89% of the ads failed to mention any side effects. The first psychiatric drugs were introduced to a very receptive public in the 1950s. The polio vaccine was contaminated with the deadly carcinogenic SV40 virus, which is found in the monkey cells of the rhesus monkey, the cells that they used to grow the polio virus. In the mid-20th century, we were told that polio was a major health crisis that took the lives of over 50,000 people in America. Dr. Jonas Salk developed the inactivated polio virus vaccine, or IPV, in 1953, and Dr. Albert Sabin developed the second polio vaccine, the oral polio vaccine, in 1957. Federal agencies began mass vaccinations in 1955. Over 90 million people worldwide were vaccinated with the IPV by 1961. 2 years later, doctors discovered that it contained SV40, which could infect and cause cancer in human cells. The American Journal of Medicine, JAMA, reported that many studies show the evidence of SV40 from the polio vaccine in brain tumors, bone cancers, malignant mesothelioma, and other cancers. The FDA, given the controversy, alerted the drug companies that they would not approve of potentially SV40 contaminated polio vaccines after June 30, 1961. However, the FDA allowed the drug companies to sell their vaccines for 2 years after the June date to save the drug companies from the financial loss on millions of doses. Some vaccine makers added rabbit anti-SV40 antibodies to their viral cultures to counteract the simian virus, which may not even be effective in eradicating the SV40. The FDA did not ascertain whether the drug companies actually destroyed their millions of dollars worth of contaminated stocks. The CDC conceded that about 10 to 30 million Americans received the SV40 contaminated IPV. Dr. Maurice Hilleman admitted that Merck's vaccines were contaminated, and he knew that their vaccinations were producing cancers in the field trials in Russia involving millions of people. Quite possibly, the polio vaccine itself caused not only cancer but polio epidemics. The infection rate was high in areas where the people failed to practice good hygiene and sanitation and where housing and nutritional standards were substandard. Paralysis only occurred in about 0.1% of all polio infections. Other symptoms were similar to viral infections like influenza. Unethical. I want you to keep all the stuff that I'm talking about in mind as you consider Ebola. Okay? Other symptoms were similar to viral infections like influenza. Unethical drug companies promoted by the government and its pro-vaccine propaganda simply vaccinated massive segments of the population because it was profitable. In the United States, following mass vaccination, the incidence of polio increased by 50% between 1957 and 1958, and by 80% from 1958 to 1959. In at least five states, the incidence of polio doubled after the vaccine operation. When people improved their hygiene and sanitation, the disease disappeared. These historical facts establish a causal connection between vaccination and its consequences. A healthy immune system is the deciding factor in whether an individual becomes ill. Okay, so please consider a coffee enema. The thing that I talked about at the beginning of the program. Vaccines destroy the immune system, which allows disease to develop. Vaccines do just the opposite of what their manufacturers claim. One may say, again, I reiterate, one may say the same thing about the recent Ebola scare, which is very comparable to the polio scare of the 1950s and 1960s. A person with an uncompromised immune system is not going to become ill, unless, of course, thousands of people accept a newly created, profitable vaccine for Ebola, a disease that has been around since 1976. Hitler did not create it. In an area that does not have the same health and sanitation standards as more developed countries. He wasn't in Africa, people. Returning to the polio issue, live virus vaccines against paralytic poliomyelitis, for example, may in each instance produce a disease, the disease it is intended to prevent. The live virus vaccines against measles and mumps may produce such side effects as encephalitis. Both of these problems are due to the inherent difficulty of controlling a live virus in vivo. In other words, after it's placed in a person. Let me check and see if we have any callers. Nope. Okay, so, I mean, I can't understand why a parent... and I'm talking about myself, too. Why a parent would allow a doctor to inject live viruses into their baby? I just want to kick myself for not looking at this at the time. And I know I'm not alone. Until 1962, drug companies did not have to submit proof of the effectiveness of their new drugs to the FDA. Therefore, it was up to the NIMH, and I'm talking here, the National Institute of Mental Health, I'm talking specifically about psychiatric drugs now, to determine whether Thorazine, a new drug, was safe. In September 1856, the National Institute of Mental Health convened a conference to consider carefully the entire psychotropic question. Participants addressed the question, how could psychiatry adapt for its own use a scientific tool that had recently proven its worth in infectious medicine, the placebo-controlled, double-blind, randomized clinical trial? Now, clinical trials, oh my gosh, talk about stacked information, preconceived notions. The 1963 to 1974 AMA Committee on Quackery, going back to quackery, targeted chiropractors attempting to discredit them. Many psychiatrists who reject chiropractic methods and their non-chemical practices belong to the American Medical Association. So there's a difference. A psychologist cannot prescribe a medication, but a psychiatrist can because they are actually medical doctors. They belong to the AMA. Now, this was during this same period that the AMA was going after chiropractors and other physicians that were not licensed by the American Medical Association. This was during the same period that corporate-sponsored television featured shows such as Dr. Ben Casey, Dr. Kildare, Marcus Well, BMD, and other Trust Your Allopathic Doctor programs. We would never see a television show featuring an alternative doctor who saves lives using natural methods or a commercial advocating that temporarily depressed people speak with a therapist, their parents, or their friends. It is all about marketing, often addictive chemical product. Now, getting back to Dr. Salk, he said in the medical journal called Science, he admitted, and this was in 1977, he admitted to a Senate committee that mass polio vaccinations caused most of the polio cases throughout the country since 1961. he said, live virus vaccines against influenza or polio may, in each instance, produce the disease it is intended to prevent. Okay? So that would include any live virus. Influenza, polio, measles, mumps, anything that has a live virus. And remember that the side effects for many of these live virus diseases is encephalitis or brain damage. In the case of measles, chickenpox, or scarlet fever, usually provides lifelong immunity, and a person rarely, if ever, gets the disease again. From 1930 to 1980, the cancer mortality rate increased from 9 per 100,000 to 80 per 100,000, or a 900% increase. Is that amazing? Now, remember what Dr. Page said about universal blood poisoning. He said no conceivable thing could have caused this increase but the universal blood poisoning, and that's what he referred to as vaccines, now existing. So, beginning with the early invasion of the Philippines and the mandatory vaccine programs, the U.S. military later decimated Japan, Germany, Vietnam, followed by the soft invasions of Central and South American countries. In 1989, Peter Kawaja, that's K-A-W-A-J-A, owned a security company, the International Security Group, Inc., in Lighthouse Point, Florida, and as such acquired information about the PIT plant, the PIT plant in Florida, which was allegedly manufacturing a cherry flavor from cherry pits. However, he determined that the company was manufacturing a weapons-grade cyanide product known as Prussian Blue. Kawaja observed that the company was actually producing MOPP gear, which is mission-oriented protective posture, a protective gear used by military personnel in a toxic environment, such as during a chemical, biological, radiological, or nuclear strike. This includes a protective mask, overgarments, M19 detector, and gloves and overboots. He contacted an FBI official who said that they were aware of the plant and suggested that Kawaja monitor the company's activities. Now, this was very easy to do, inasmuch as his security company had been hired by the PIT plant, and he was knowledgeable about various surveillance techniques. Thereafter, he tapped phones and searched documents and built a case of the treasonous and criminal activities perpetrated by the owners of the plant. It was not long. This was about in 1989. Okay, this was before the first Gulf War. Okay, so he tapped phones, searched documents, he built a case of treasonous and criminal activities perpetrated by the owners of the plant. It was not long before he discovered that top U.S. government officials, including Henry Kissinger, who created the MM-220 about depopulation, and top military officials were collaborating with the owners of the PIT plant. Henry Kissinger, one-time U.S. Secretary of State, remember what he said? And I quote, military men are just dumb, stupid animals to be used as pawns for foreign policy, unquote. The owners of the PIT plant were also in partnership with various factions of the Mossad and the Israelis. Kawaja also discovered that internationally minded prominent people in England, Switzerland, and some in Latin America planned the manufacturing operations at the PIT plant. It is important to remember that this manufacturing activity at the PIT plant was prior to the first Gulf War, but was in preparation for it. Certain factions previously mentioned intended to expose vast numbers of the American military to a combination of biological and chemical weapons. The Pitt plant was preparing and testing the mop gear that the government would provide American soldiers. However, the Prussian blue would neutralize the mop gear's protection and make it permeable to the bio and chemical weapons, which the U.S. military would disperse upon those soldiers as planned by the alliance previously mentioned, the Mossad, the Israelis, and the U.S. government. Okay, they planned to disperse bio and chemical weapons upon the U.S. soldiers. Okay, they used them as guinea pigs. Additionally, before their deployment to the Gulf, the government mandated a multitude of experimental drugs, some supposedly to protect the soldiers against the various bioweapons that they might encounter, all without informed consent by the soldiers. Khawaja recorded numerous telephone calls and was aware of what the Pitt management and their collaborators were planning. Pitt may have had another location in addition to the one that he was surveilling. Therefore, top government and military officials participated, along with the Israeli Mossad and other international interests, in exposing the American military to, and I quote, lethal and disabling biological and chemical weapons, while telling the soldier subjects, victims, that their mop gear would protect them, unquote. There always has to be a cover story for a large-scale operation where people are slaughtered or biologically assaulted. There is a cover story for the Gulf War Syndrome, GWS, which affected approximately 250,000 of the 697,000 U.S. veterans who fought in the 1991 Gulf War. It's a very short war. GWS is an enduring, chronic, multi-symptom illness, a condition with serious consequences, possibly used to downsize the very people who could capably fight against culprits and protect the country. The official version of what caused GWS includes depleted uranium, sarin gas, smoke from burning oil wells, contaminated vaccines, combat stress, and psychological factors. Let me just check and see what's going on in the chat room. All righty. The Institute of Medicine found that the chronic multi-symptom illness continues to affect these veterans nearly 20 years after the war. Hundreds of thousands of soldiers were exposed. In the first Gulf War, there were very few Americans who died, and the war was relatively short, a few months. Although not many soldiers died, many of them got incredibly sick and died later from vague diseases. Various people perpetuate the official story and contribute it to the story that Rumsfeld sold weapons of mass destruction to Saddam Hussein, which is not the case, despite the photo that many of us have seen and despite the Riegel report, R-I-E-G-L-E. Riegel was in a predicament, and the way that he could extricate himself from the indictment for his role in the King Five scandal was to blame Iraq, and specifically Saddam Hussein, for the destruction of his country. The report became official and part of the 103rd National Congress and functioned to distract people from Peter Khawaja's substantial amount of evidence. Saddam Hussein did not buy weapons from the U.S., not from Rumsfeld, and despite Riegel's report, Iraq did not cause the U.S. military personnel to suffer from Gulf War syndrome. Now, the reasons that the U.S. invaded Iraq in 1991 are, and this is from our wonderful friend, Buthena, the U.S. did not want Iraq to support Palestine. Number two, Rumsfeld asked Hussein to give 80% of the oil benefits to the U.S. corporations. Number three, Rumsfeld, speaking on behalf of the U.S., wanted to to destroy the National Arab Brotherhood. To substantiate and decrease the responsibility of the vile villains who perpetrated an assault against at least 250,000 people, skilled operatives were positioned within the media to marginalize Peter Khawaja and his evidence. Certainly, using contaminated vaccines or depleted uranium on military personnel is a terrible travesty. What someone once referred to as the S-curve stories replace the idea of experimental vaccines given to unwitting soldiers for the purpose of exposing them to deadly and disabling chemical bioweaponry with the story of contaminated vaccines and then denying the fact that veterans were becoming ill with unrecognizable diseases. I mean, that kind of takes all the culpability. It's that old whoops factor. And so many people buy into the whoops factor. One can always exploit the whoops factor if people do not buy the story of the Iraqis poisoning the American soldiers. Cover stories usually suggest that government officials had some part in a crime, such as the uranium or vaccine issues, but the evidence is not forthcoming. And then there's always the official stack commissions during which the members conceal or preclude the evidence, and distracted people conclude that there might be something a bit fishy without realizing it's not just a matter of a can of abandoned tuna fish, but a 50-ton whale. I always wondered about the depleted uranium justification. How could all of these veterans have a depleted uranium issue with its ubiquitous distribution and not have thousands of depleted uranium victims in the Israeli state? Well, I wonder. Khawaja, hoping to warn people before and after the war erupted, created a veterans organization and was making an effort to prosecute top officials for war crimes and treason for which he had evidence. He initiated court action and submitted sufficient evidence with government attorneys, and who apparently locked up all of this information while they were in the process of creating perpetual delays. Operatives attempted to steal his evidence. Ultimately, his wife died of, would you believe, Ebola in their home. Someone burned his home down. While waiting for 15 minutes for the fire department to respond, and keep in mind the fire department was located in the next block, federal agents seized all the evidence that he still had in his home, and this was in addition to the evidence that he gave to government attorneys. Anyway, they seized all this evidence while Khawaja was receiving oxygen from the paramedics. The government stored Khawaja's massive amount of evidence, some that he formally submitted and some that the government seized. Would you believe that they stored it in a 9-story Alfred P. Murrah federal building, along with the records for 700,000 veterans of the first Gulf War? Oh my gosh, what a coincidence. On April 19, 1995, all of those records would be destroyed, along with 168 people, while 680 people were injured. Shortly after domestic terrorists destroyed the Murrah building, operatives befriended Khawaja, seeking whatever evidence he retained regarding the government's treachery against its own citizens, evidently with the intention of marginalizing it to cover government culpability. Khawaja was not so naive to notice the discrepancies of the operatives and distanced himself from them. Let me just check and see if there's any callers. Nope, no callers. Okay, back to the chat room. However, the operatives were able to disseminate the official story, whose credibility grew with its repetitive rehearsals on numerous radio programs and conferences. People who had heard about Khawaja and his evidence stopped talking about it as the cover story grew, repeated ad nauseum. Rumsfeld sold weapons to Saddam Hussein, supported by the Riegel report. The government used contaminated vaccines, depleted uranium, and biochemical weapons, most notably anthrax. Khawaja started a new veterans organization, had a website, and was a co-host on a radio program, but was soon relegated to the sidelines despite the fact that he had the most damning evidence that would have helped every citizen to regain his or her freedom, not to mention the help that the veterans and their families might have received. In August 1990, the United States military besieged, and let me just show you what they did in Iraq and the aftermath. In August 1990, the United States military besieged Iraqis' electricity production facilities, nuclear reactors, port facilities, telecommunications equipment, oil refineries and distribution, railroads and bridges. By the end of the first Gulf War, Iraq had only 4% of its pre-war electricity. Invading forces had damaged or rendered unusable 50 railroad and highway bridges between Basra and Baghdad. Bombs destroyed 8 multi-purpose dams, 4 of the 7 pumping stations, and 31 municipal water and sewage facilities, 20 in Baghdad, which resulted in sewage pouring into the Tigris, Iraq's water source. Water purification plants were incapacitated throughout Iraq. A UN report from mid-March described near-apocalyptic damage to the nation's infrastructure, which left the country in a pre-industrial stage. Age. In addition, according to the survey team report, the destruction of 9,000 homes had left some 72,000 Iraqis homeless. On January 22, 1991, officials published Iraq water treatment vulnerabilities, warning that without the addition of chlorine to purify the water, diseases such as cholera, hepatitis, and typhoid would occur. The United States imposed sanctions against Iraq, the worst in modern history, to halt their alleged aggression against Kuwait, and if true, should have ended with Iraqis' withdrawal from that country, if not for the combined influence of the United States and Britain with the UN. Iraq agreed to a ceasefire on February 22, 1991. They had 3 weeks to withdraw their troops to within their pre-invasion borders. The United States accepted the entire proposal and promised that American troops would not harm retreating Iraqi soldiers. Accordingly, a safe withdrawal would begin within 24 hours. General Merrill McPeak, Air Force Chief of Staff, declared in a March 15, 1991 briefing that this war was the first time in history that a field army had been defeated by air power. He estimated that 88,500 people, only 7.4%, were precision-guided. Tons of bombs had been dropped and 109,876 aircraft sorties. This was more intense than the 34,000 tons per month during the Vietnam War or the 22,000 tons per month during the Korean War. On May 1991, these diseases were pandemic in the refugee camps due to inadequate water and poor sanitation. American bombs, as I indicated, destroyed 9,000 homes, leaving 72,000 Iraqis homeless. Dr. David Levinson visited Iraq immediately after the Gulf War on behalf of International Physicians for the Prevention of Nuclear War. He said, and I quote, "For many weeks, people in Baghdad, without television, radio, or newspapers to warn them, brought their drinking water from the Tigris in buckets," unquote. He said, and I quote, "Dehydrated from nausea and diarrhea, craving liquids, they drank more of the water that made them sick in the first place," unquote. Thousands died from drinking polluted water. Ohio Representative Tony Hall wrote to the Secretary of State, Madeleine Albright, voicing concerns about what he called profound effects of the deterioration of Iraq's water supply and sanitation systems had on the children's health. Sorry. Diarrhea in children under 5 occurred in epidemic proportions, the leading cause of death in that age group. The Pentagon later admitted in a report on June 23, 1991, that the targets were not limited to military targets, but they deliberately did great harm to Iraq's ability to support itself as an industrial society. Interestingly, the CDC altered and greatly increased the number of vaccines in its schedule twice, once in 1991, with the first Gulf War and again in 2001 in conjunction with the Patriot Act and the second invasion of Iraq. Of course, those CDC changes would affect the U.S. military that we're going to be fighting again and against Iraq. Okay, we're running short on time here. After the obliteration of the infrastructure and the accompanying pollution of the water supply, the UN Security Council then inflicted strict economic sanctions on Iraq with Resolution 661, which began on August 6, 1990 and continued until May 22, 2003. Sanctions for over a decade prohibited the importation of all products and the exportation of products originating in Iraq or Kuwait. Punitive sanctions critically restricted the import of the basic essentials to sustain life, which severely affects the most vulnerable in any society, the children, of which 500,000 perished during that period. And we know what that bitch, what was her, I'm sorry, she is, Madeleine Albright, I'm sorry. I don't usually get mad, I don't usually cuss, but I can't think of a better word to call her. I really can't. She said it was worth it. Okay, the United States is still in Iraq. Once a progressive, self-sustaining country whose citizens enjoyed a high living standard, which is now a desperately impoverished country whose health care system is now non-existent. On April 10, 2014, UNICEF, which purchases 40% of the vaccines for third world or apparently war-torn countries, began a polio vaccine campaign after the discovery of the first confirmed case of polio. Remember, polio comes from lack of sanitation. And this is actually the second national immunization campaign, the first one being in March. So UNICEF's representative in Iraq, a person by the name of Marzio Babil, indicated that the organization wants to vaccinate every child in Iraq with three WHO-recommended doses of the vaccine, especially the 5.5 million children under the age of five. This is just another assault, a massive assault against Iraq. One must ask, has the U.S. military, and does the U.S. military continue to invade the world's countries for various reasons in order to establish the World Health Organization and the provably unhealthy Western health system, which often replaces more natural, more effective health-enhancing medical modalities? Given America's health statistics, why would anyone willingly embrace America's medical protocols? Willingly is an operative word. A sick, highly medicated, chemically lobotomized population is incapable of fighting tyranny, of retaining and protecting a nation's natural resources. Many people believe that the U.S. military invades other countries in order to establish a central bank and seize intellectual and natural resources. I suggest that it is also to medically decimate the native population in the name of long-term guaranteed profits. There are numerous countries that the legitimate, not to mention the illegitimate, drug industry now does business within, including Japan, China, Vietnam, Germany, and many Middle East countries. For over six decades, the pharmaceutical industry has concealed the dangers of vaccinations in the name of profit. Darn, I'm mad. I'm really mad. This is just, I'm sorry. I really get upset against these monsters. And I blame the pharmaceutical industry and the U.S. military, who apparently is financially enhancing the pharmaceutical industry, which has concealed vaccinations, the dangers of vaccinations, the dangers of pharmaceutical drugs, all in the name of profit. Under normal circumstances, the body's natural defenses and immune system neutralize diseases as they enter the body through the nose, mouth, skin, lungs. You also have your tonsils, unless somebody took them out. Even your appendix is part of your immune system. And, of course, we have all kinds of other things, GMOs, chemtrails, which is probably vaccine by aircraft. Anyway, vaccines are injected directly into the bloodstream and bypass the body's very effective defense system. Dr. Vera Schneider wrote, and I quote, "The documented truth is that the incidence of and mortality from any infectious diseases which used to decimate populations of Europe only some 100 years ago declined by up to 90% before any vaccine had ever been used in mass proportions. Also, diseases like bubonic plague or scarlet fever disappeared without any vaccination programs at all. The mortality from the dreaded diphtheria declined decades before Corynebacterium diphtheria had ever been discovered and isolated." So, I guess what I'm saying is, you have to ask yourself, why is it that the U.S. military is being used, being decimated by vaccines? Why are they being used to invade countries, to destroy those countries? Look what they did. Look what they did in Germany, what they did in Japan, now what they've done in Liberia, in Afghanistan, Iraq, and certainly embedded corporations are used supposedly to rebuild the infrastructure. But I know that that's not being done in Afghanistan. Afghanistan is still a rubble heap. Iraq is still a rubble heap. And the reason that so many Iraqis have left their homeland, and so many Afghans have left their homeland, is because of the destruction. They would still be there. They would still be enjoying a progressive country that was well developed. And like I said, Saddam Hussein was simply saying no to the demands of the U.S. government. The U.S. government did not sell Saddam Hussein any weapons of mass destruction. You cannot blame what happened to the soldiers in the first Gulf War on Saddam Hussein. You cannot blame them on contaminated vaccines. You cannot really blame the Gulf War syndrome on depleted uranium. It is because of the experimental devices that were produced by the Pitt plant that Peter Khawaja talked about and documented, that, it's got to have a cover story for everything that happens. Anyway, I appreciate you joining me today on this program. I'm sorry that I called that woman the name that I called her, but that I just get really ticked off. I know that profanity is not good, but I just couldn't think of another word for her. Anyway, thanks for joining me today. And keep these things in mind. Educate others. Educate yourself. Thank you so very much for joining me.
It starts with you and me.
It starts with you.
It starts with you and me.